This is Culturetopia, a look back at the week's best art stories from National Public Radio. I'm Netta Ulibi, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Franny Kelly, producer for NPR Music.
Every week, we bring you the best cultural coverage, from books and music to movies, television, and everything in between.
And you can find links to all the stories we feature each week at npr.org/culturetopia.
This week, we remember legendary songwriter Ellie Greenwich.
We hear a South African reaction to the new science fiction film, District 9.
And director R.J. Cutler talks about his latest documentary. It spotlights everyone's favorite Prada-wearing editrix, Anna Wintour of Vogue magazine.
But first,
Reading Rainbow was for 26 years one of public television's most popular children's programs. Before it ended last week, the show entertained millions of kids and won tons of awards. PBS's decision to end the show signals a change in philosophy as to how television should teach reading. Here's Ben Calhoun.
Even if you can't remember a specific Reading Rainbow episode, chances are the theme song is still stuck in your head somewhere.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high.
Reading Rainbow started in 1983. Hosted by actor LeVar Burton. If you don't know Burton from Reading Rainbow, he's also famous for his role as Kunta Kinte in Roots or the chrome-visored Geordi LaForge on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Hey! I'm glad you're here.
Each episode of Reading Rainbow had the same basic elements. There was a featured children's book and then an adventure with Burton that related back to the featured book. The third part to all of this was the book reviews. Towards the end of the show, kids appeared on screen and recommended books to each other.
Yo, my name is Pete, and I got a book for you. It's all about music, and I think you'll dig it too.
Hi there, my name is Laura Delgado, and I'm here today to tell you about a very special book I've just finished reading.
Hello up there in outer space. My name is Carlos Rodriguez. Well, boy, have I got a book for you.
But it wasn't just the structure of the show that made it stand out. It was the substance.
We're going on a hayride down to Smiley Hollow for a good old-fashioned Tennessee barn dance.
The show had light themes like barn dances and honeybees, but it never shied away from tougher issues.
Not all of us have experienced what it's like to have a parent in prison, but millions of children have.
In 26 years, Reading Rainbow won more than 24 Emmys and became the third longest-running children's show in PBS history. It's topped only by Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers.
The series resonates with so many people.
John Grant is in charge of content at WNED, Reading Rainbow's home station. Grant says Reading Rainbow is ending today because nobody, not the station, not PBS, not CPB, nobody's putting up the money to renew the show's broadcast rights, a cost of several hundred thousand dollars. He says that partially has to do with a funding crunch. But more interesting, Grant says the decision to end Reading Rainbow can also be traced back to a philosophical change about TV and reading. He says the change started with the Department of Education under the Bush administration, which wanted to see a much heavier focus on things like phonics and spelling, the basic tools of reading.
PBS and CPB and the Department of Education all put significant funding really toward the idea of programming that would teach kids how to read.
Reading Rainbow was not what they wanted.
That was never what Reading Rainbow did. Reading Rainbow taught kids why to read, you know, the love of reading, encouraged kids to pick up a book and to read.
I think in many ways Reading Rainbow, in terms of literacy, represents the era that it was developed in.
Linda Siminski is the vice president of children's programming at PBS.
I think maybe in the early 80s, the thought was, how do we get kids to read books?
Siminski says Reading Rainbow came up against research that shows teaching the mechanics of reading should be the network's priority.
We've been able to identify the earliest steps that we need to take. You know, now we know what we need to do first. Even just from 5 years ago, I think we all know so much more about how to use television to teach.
Siminski calls Reading Rainbow's 26-year run miraculous and calls its end bittersweet. Still, talking to others in children's programming, it seems Reading Rainbow's impending absence hangs like an open question about the literacy challenges that still exist and the role television should play to meet those challenges. For NPR News, I'm Ben Calhoun in New York.
Franny, do you have a favorite Reading Rainbow story?
Well, yes, I was once on Reading Rainbow. I didn't get to be one of the kids that recommended a book, but I won this poetry contest when I was 9, and so they put my picture up, and I never saw it, though. We'll go now to a story about another cultural icon who ended before her time. Ellie Greenwich was a rarity, a woman in the music business who found great success writing and producing hit after popular hit. Greenwich, one of the great songwriters, died last week. She was 68 years old. Netta, let's hear your obituary.
Along with Phil Spector and her then-husband, Jeff Berry, Ellie Greenwich created this song. And this one. So I whispered, I love you. You said that you loved me too, and then you kissed me. And this one. Just because Ellie Greenwich earned 25 gold and platinum records doesn't mean she could predict a hit. Here she is a few years ago on WHYY's Fresh Air.
In my whole career of being in the studio producing, there were only two songs that I literally walked out of a studio and said, either these records are going to be zippity-doo, nothing, go nowhere, or number one records. That was Chapel of Love and Leader of the Pack.
Ellie Greenwich started her career writing songs for her cheerleading squad on Long Island. Her music would help define the American teenager in the 1960s.
It wasn't that accepted back then, a female being in that end of the business.
Honestly, it's not even all that accepted now. Women break into the industry as singers. Greenwich was a good singer, but her Midas touch as a writer and producer earned her a perch in the Brill Building, New York City's famed pop music factory, along with Carole King. Ellie Greenwich told NPR that the girl groups she produced were not always happy about a woman in charge.
At first it was like, well, who does she think she is giving us orders here or telling us what to do? But on the other end, if you just were very open with them, they saw they could be your friend, and then it became an asset to be a woman dealing with the girl groups.
The Ronettes, the Crystals, the Shangri-Las. Greenwich's music sold in the tens of millions, but she felt upstaged, like many other American songwriters, by the British invasion. She endured a painful divorce and a nervous breakdown. Both were part of an autobiographical Broadway show that opened in the 1980s. Jimmy Iovine is the chairman of Interscope Records.
Very few people have as many classic songs as Ellie Greenwich did. She was incredible.
Iovine says Greenwich discovered Neil Diamond and worked with Cyndi Lauper, Desmond Child, and Ike and Tina Turner. Iovine says if he had to pick just one favorite Ellie Greenwich song, it'd be River Deep, Mountain High. But Ellie Greenwich left us dozens upon dozens of songs. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
When I was a little girl, I had a rag doll. Only doll I've ever owned. Now I love you just the way.
Long Island has produced a chair of legends, including a great big one with extremely sharp teeth. Writer Lizzie Skernick says as a young girl, she missed seeing the movie Jaws and all its gory action. But when she snagged a copy of the steamy paperback by Peter Benchley, she found she was more interested in cataloging the dirty words than whether they'd catch that killer shark. Skernick talks about Jaws as part of the All Things Considered series, My Guilty Pleasure, in which writers tell us about the books they're embarrassed to love.
You're supposed to feel guilty when you secretly like the movie of a book better than the book itself. But in the case of Jaws, a book I read and reread long before I was allowed to see the film, I'm far more embarrassed to admit I prefer the novel. Because while Jaws the movie is a bone-chilling update on Moby Dick, Jaws the novel is more like Peyton Place by the sea. Everyone swears like a sailor, and the hunt for the shark comes a very distant second to a bunch of hot summer trysts. Take Police Chief Martin Brody, the likable family man played by Roy Scheider in the movie. He's haunted by all the deaths he could have prevented. But in the book, he's also a frustrated cuckold whose unsatisfied wife is noodling around with a handsome ichthyologist. In the film, a chattery Richard Dreyfuss gets to live. But in the book, suavely seductive Matt Cooper gets eaten alive. And since you've seen exactly what he did to Brody's wife in a hotel a few chapters earlier, you know he totally deserves it. I'm also secretly addicted to Benchley's skill with the well-placed obscenity. Sure, now we're used to a few R-rated bombs dropped in prime time, but even 35 years ago, Benchley would have put your average episode of The Sopranos to shame. I finally saw the movie version of Jaws, and I have to give it to Spielberg. It worked. I'm still scared to wade out past my knees. But I'm perfectly happy to sit on the shore and crack open the paperback. Unlike the scary scenes in the movie, when you get to the good parts of this book, you don't have to cover your eyes.
Speaking of bloody chum, the movie District 9 opens with the ominous arrival of a huge spaceship with creepy-looking aliens.
Now, to everyone's surprise, the ship didn't come to a stop over Manhattan or Washington or Chicago, but instead coasted to a halt directly over the city of Johannesburg.
But District 9 is more than another alien invasion sci-fi flick. Set in Johannesburg, South Africa, the film touches on themes of apartheid, xenophobia, and redemption. District 9 has become an unexpected hit in the U.S. since it opened earlier this month, and last week it premiered in South Africa. Amy Costello went there to find out how the film was received and has this report.
Many of those emerging from theaters over the weekend responded to subtleties in District 9 that may have been lost on many American audiences. Start with the film's title.
In some ways, a little bit shocking, just thinking of District 6.
That's Christo Skitter. He's referring to Cape Town's District 6, a neighborhood just a few miles from the cinema from which thousands of South Africans were forcibly removed during apartheid. Skitter said watching the graphic, hyper-real removals of aliens from their homes by South African security forces in the fictional District 9 made him reflect on the real-life forced removals in Cape Town's District 6.
What happened there, you know, some of that I never really understood because I never really experienced that. So for me, that was a shock, you know, being a white South African in some sense to kind of see that.
But for Jamela Hovani, a 26-year-old black South African, imagery of her nation's ugly past is a bad message to send out to the rest of the world.
It was a representation of the old South Africa, you know, like apartheid state, the white people running the police state, and the black people living in the slums. Just the whole setup of the movie, it reminded me of the whole apartheid era.
In the film, security forces attempt to evict a million or so aliens from their homes. They call the aliens prawns, a derogatory term for the huge, scaly creatures. The prawns are violently forced into camps, led by the film's leading character, a man whom many here pointed out is an Afrikaner.
It's the Afrikaner nation. Well, you can say generally it's the Afrikaners who were the apartheid people.
Janet Daffy is not Afrikaans herself, but she says the evolution of the Afrikaner lead from the alien's foe to friend is a fitting tribute to post-apartheid South Africa. But some viewed the lead character more critically.
The lead character? I don't know if they wanted to cast him as a hero.
That's Fortune Sabanda, a 33-year-old South African resident from Zimbabwe. He says the Afrikaner's decision to help the aliens was driven by self-preservation. He only acted to save the aliens when he begins to morph into an ugly alien himself, sprouting a huge, scaly arm.
I'm not sure if he didn't grow that, he would identify with them. He would sympathize with them. So for me, he's not a hero. He's just affected. He's driven by self-interest.
The film's numerous graphic scenes of forced removals by heavily armed troops provided a visceral flashback of recent real-life violence in South Africa. Last year, the nation was rocked by a series of deadly xenophobic attacks on foreigners. Fortune Sabanda, himself a foreigner, said the film's apparent message of tolerance was undermined at every turn by a liberal use of what he sees as racial and ethnic stereotypes. Sabanda points to the masses of impoverished blacks and aliens living in shantytowns.
I think what it does is to look at Africa from, I'm sorry to say it, but from white eyes. You know what I'm saying? The fear that the African is a cannibal who wants to eat other people to assimilate their power. So in trying to do all that, I think the movie totally failed at the end of the day.
Even so, District 9 was selling out on Friday night, and ticket sales remained strong over the weekend. For NPR News, I'm Amy Costello in Cape Town, South Africa.
Part of what makes District 9 work is that it's a fake documentary. The September issue is a real one. Its subject is the traditionally enormous 500-plus page September issue. Of course, it's edited by Anna Wintour. The director of the film, The September Issue, is R.J. Cutler. He joined NPR's Melissa Block to talk about the movie.
In the case of Anna, I had this idea to make a film about her. Here's somebody who everybody's heard of, who's caricatured throughout our popular culture in movies, novels, even in The Incredibles, there's an Anna Wintour-esque figure.
Movies and, like The Devil Wears Prada.
And yes, and entire films are based on her. And yet, nobody really knows who she is. And I approached her, and to be honest, it was a very easy sell. We met. We started talking. This is very Anna. She's probably not going to meet with you unless she's interested in working with you. And by the end of maybe a 20-minute meeting, we were off and running.
And the frame is the September 2007 issue that they're putting together.
Yes, that's right. And it turns out to have been the single largest issue of any magazine that's ever been published. It's almost as if the day we stopped filming, the whole world changed. But at that moment for that year, we really captured a kind of very particular period of time.
You said you were interested in people who need to tell their stories. Anna Wintour looks so completely uncomfortable. Let's take a listen to one scene from the movie that I think is probably what I felt to be the most revelatory moment that she gives you in this movie. She's talking about her brothers and sister and the good works they do. She has a brother who finds low-income housing in London, a sister who's involved with farmers' rights in Latin America, another brother who's a political editor. And here's how she describes what they think about what she does.
My two brothers and my sister, I think they're very amused by what I do. They're amused. So,
R.J. Cutler, what were you thinking when you saw her face and heard her voice as she opened up to you there?
Well, you see in the film, and I saw for many, many months, a woman who, everywhere she goes, the waters part. The entire industry kind of responds to Anna's tastes, her likes, her dislikes. And yet, this is a person who, like so many other powerful, successful people, has doubts. She's human.
The counterpoint in the film to Anna Wintour, and to some extent the comic relief here, is Grace Coddington, the creative director of Vogue, joined the magazine at the same time as Anna Wintour did. She's a dramatic presence on screen. She's a former model. She's got this big mane of flame-red hair. She's acerbic. She stands up to Anna. Tell me about Grace Coddington and how she became part of this film, such a big part of this film.
Well, she's quite amazing. And, you know, within the fashion world, Grace is every bit the legend that Anna is. So the idea that these two women would be working, you know, a few doors down from each other, it's quite amazing. Anna's office, as you see in the film, is kind of a freezer of efficiency. And yet then there's Grace Coddington's office just a little bit down the hall, where there might as well be a hookah pipe in the middle of this. Everybody's lounging around, relaxing, being creative, being thoughtful. It's like, you know, it's an incubator of creativity. Grace is forever wanting to push certain boundaries. Anna is forever supportive, but in her way, in it being an editor, cutting things. Grace says early on in the movie, a lot of people have come and a lot of people have gone under Anna Wintour's reign at Vogue. And the reason people go is because they can't take the heartbreak. On one hand, when you see the movie, you see the heartbreak that Grace is talking about. But on the other hand, you see a woman, Grace Coddington, who's willing to have her heart broken. That means she's willing to fall in love month after month with this extraordinary work she's doing.
When I saw the movie, Franny, when you first meet Grace Coddington and you didn't know anything about fashion, which I don't really,
she presents as such this crazy old lady that my first thought was, Vogue, you know, I thought it was such a terrible place, but they're clearly very kindly letting this crazy old lady work there. They must be very charitable. And it's, turns out she runs away with the entire movie. You can hear the entire interview at our website, npr.org/culturetopia.
The music scene of Tijuana once teemed with nightclubs and thousands of American revelers. But that's changed as border security has increased on both sides to deal with illegal immigration and drug gangs. And so the character of Tijuana's music scene has evolved as well. Reporter Corey Takahashi explores that change with this profile of a group of longtime Tijuana musicians called the Nortec Collective.
When you drive through Tijuana, you feel like you're twirling the dial on a radio of live musicians.
Here on the sidewalk, there are some Norteño walking
musicians.
Because they usually play on the streets or play in the restaurants around here.
Nortec Collective musician Fusible is showing off a Norteño hangout near his home. There's a bullfighting ring and a beach, so there are restaurants and a captive audience for this folk music from northern Mexico. In this slice of Tijuana, you could listen to plaintive songs about life on the border and catch a breeze off the Pacific Ocean while saltwater eats away at the ragged border fence on the shore.
There's music all over the place down here.
Yeah, I mean, this is normal in Tijuana, to have music very loud.
Some of the musicians take requests and play for tips. Fusible, whose real name is Pepe Moc, gets approached by a few. This Norteño street performer covers a classic from the group Los Tigres del Norte.
La policía solo halló una pistola tirada del dinero y de camelia.
Norteño musicians are a traditional cowboy hat-wearing crowd. Nortec Collective takes this traditional Norteño and reinterprets it through synthesizers, drum machines, and a grab bag of other digital tools. The musician Bostich, whose actual name is Ramon Amezcua, composed this track, Tijuana Sound Machine.
We were thinking about a machine, a car that can take you to the imaginary trip to Tijuana and take you to different places from our city.
The mythical Tijuana Sound Machine appeared on the cover of their last album. It's a rugged, cherry-red lowrider that has speakers for rims. This evening, Bostich is driving a dowdy gray minivan, a symbol of his other Tijuana life. He's a father of four and a part-time orthodontist. These have been trying years for his city. A wave of drug violence and kidnappings led to border crackdowns on both sides. Bostich says that's kept Americans away from Tijuana, including musicians he used to collaborate with. Tijuana culture has turned inward.
Before it was a small fence. Now it's like a huge wall, like with roads and lamps and helicopters, you know, border patrols, you know, motorcycles and stuff like that. It's like a huge paranoia for the border.
Franny, will you tell a little bit about the picture that Corey sent you that you can see on our website?
Yeah, Corey Takahashi took a great photo of the two men he spoke to in Nortec Collective, just standing right at the border. And you can see how small it really is in some places.
And he said that there was a wall.
Well, in some places the border is huge and heavily fortified, and other places, especially by the water, it's just, you know, a chain-link fence that sort of fades into the ocean.
And on that image, that's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Franny Kelly.
And I'm Netta Ulibi.
Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.